U.S. versus Bakari.
May it please the court, Chris Bartolomucci for the appellant, Raza Bakari. We have three issues in this case.
Taken, Mr. Bakari is not with you.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. We have three issues in this case, jurisdiction, fugitive status, and the merits. I'll go in that order. With respect to jurisdiction, this court has appellate jurisdiction because the district court's order is final as a practical matter. The district court said that Mr. Bakari is not entitled to a ruling on his motion to dismiss because, in that court's view, he is a fugitive. Now, with that ruling, the district court proceedings have come to an end. There will be no trial, therefore there will be no post-trial appeal. Under both the doctrine of practical finality and the collateral order doctrine, this is an appealable order. As to the collateral order doctrine, the district court's order conclusively determined the question. It determined an important issue that was separate from the merits of Mr. Bakari's guilt or innocence, and it's effectively unreviewable on appeal from a final judgment.
Well, I'm confused. I thought the district court decided not to decide. I thought the district court decided not to address the motion.
The district court decided not to address the merits of the motion. It denied the motion based on the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. So it did rule on the motion. It didn't rule on the merits being raised. So the question of whether he's a fugitive was ruled upon, and the court ruled against my client.
Is it possible, Mr. Bartolomucci, that we've got jurisdiction over one claim but not the other? Kashamu seems to be a pretty good case for considering your comity argument based on the Pakistan rejection of the extradition request. But as far as Speedy Trial Act claims go, whether constitutional, rule-based, or statutory, we've got McDonald telling us this is not a collateral order that can be considered.
Well, that, of course, is a ruling in the context of a defendant who is present in the United States and is facing an imminent trial.
Right, but it also says that those sorts of issues are deeply fact-intensive. You can't really evaluate the relevant factors until you've had a trial, and you can, for example, develop a record for prejudice and so on. Obviously, as far as Speedy Trial Act goes, you agree that there is a remedy readily available to your client.
Well, we didn't raise the Act claim, of course, only the constitutional claim. But I would have to disagree with Your Honor about speedy trial claims being adjudicated post-trial. In fact, they ordinarily are decided pre-trial.
No, they're not appealable. They're not appealable then because you wait until you see what happens. That's what McDonald tells us.
Well,
right, it's all wiped out. An adverse ruling to your client's all wiped out by acquittal.
Well, I think an important point to make here is that normally you don't want an interlocutory appeal because then you're going to delay the trial. You interrupt the proceedings in the district court. But that's not going to happen here. We're not heading to a trial. So you're hearing this case doesn't slow anything down in the district court.
It's been slowed down quite a bit.
Yes, it has, Your Honor. And if we could, perhaps this is a good point to move to the issue of whether Mr. Bakari is a fugitive. And I've got really two arguments to present to the court. The first is that he's not a fugitive because he didn't flee and he didn't hide.
Well, you don't have to wait till you're indicted to become to flee. You can leave in anticipation of trouble coming along.
Well, I think the cases
and still
would
be a fugitive.
I think the cases would support the view that if you leave the country either post indictment or in the face of an imminent indictment, that's fleeing. But that's not this case.
How about the Second Circuit's decisions in Blanco and Catino, both of which seem to suggest pretty clearly that if you're abroad and you learn you've been indicted and don't come back, that you're a fugitive.
Well, I think those, if that's how the court reads those cases, I think those cases are either wrong or don't apply to the facts of this case, where my client, again, didn't flee, didn't hide, and then most importantly...
So you just disagree with them.
I do disagree with them, but I also think those are cases where the defendants left the country either post-indictment or in the face of an imminent indictment, which isn't the case here.
Is that a workable line?
Well, I think it is. Certainly in this case, when
and
you
how leave, do we how do we test your client's knowledge if he won't show up at the embassy for a deposition?
Well, when you leave 2 years before the indictment, I think you can't call that in face of an imminent indictment. But one additional important fact to put on the table here is what happened in Pakistan.
These cases don't get filed overnight. A case of this type can take a while to gather documents and interview witnesses and so forth, and word starts getting out that the FBI or whoever it is looking into things well before the day of indictment.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
A couple of years is really not a long time on this type of investigation.
Well, if the argument that he didn't flee or hide isn't moving the court, I think my second argument is that he went through the extradition process. This is a legally required process. It's required under the United States Treaty. The government initiated that process as it had to. This was not something Bukhari threw up as a defensive measure. And he prevailed in that process. He obtained...
Is that over?
Yes, it is over.
It was over. Over. I mean, it's...
Yes, it was over.
It's not appealable.
It's not appealable. It was
so
over.
Can I just skip ahead, Mr. Bartolomucci, a little bit to the merits of your comedy argument? If I understand you correctly, your position is that a defendant who successfully defeats an extradition request is entitled to dismissal of the indictment in the United States.
Under the doctrine of comity, on a without prejudice basis, that's correct.
Just automatically?
Well, I think you have to ask for it. You know, we have asked for
it. Okay. Has any other court adopted that view?
No, sir, but I think that it's a fair extension of Kishamu, in which this court likened an extradition ruling to a no probable cause finding under 5.1.
I thought Kishamu rejected the collateral estoppel argument.
Well, I'm not making a collateral estoppel argument.
What's the difference?
The difference, again, Kishamu said, hey, the foreign court found a particular fact, which means that I win. That's not what I'm saying. Kishamu also said, foreign extradition rulings are like a no probable cause finding, and the judgments of foreign extradition courts should be given respect and deference. Under Rule 5.1, the effect of a no probable cause ruling is that the accused is released.
Right, but we've got an indictment. No American judge could dismiss this for lack of probable cause, right?
I think they can, given the foreign extradition judgment.
Well,
that's the question.
That is your question. How would your argument apply to a country that doesn't have an extradition treaty? Does it not apply at all?
On which issue, Your Honor?
Comedy.
On comedy? It wouldn't apply because you have to rely.
How would it apply to a country then that has an extradition treaty that is not actually honored in practice? Obviously, there's a lot of controversy from time to time between governments about certain extradition matters and how much cooperation there actually is.
Well, Your Honor, under Kishamu, the place that you start is that you give deference and respect to the foreign court judgment. Now, I suppose if the government could make a showing that the extradition judgment was a complete sham, then you wouldn't give deference to it.
Well, this was pretty strange, right? Saying most of the government's evidence couldn't be considered and requiring the government to produce essentially all of its evidence in Pakistan as opposed to just respecting, for example, the indictment.
No. With all due respect, Your Honor, I think it wasn't a strange ruling. The United States proffered one piece of evidence, which was the affidavit of an accomplice. And what the inquiry magistrate said in Pakistan was, look, you haven't given me any witness testimony from a non-accomplice, and you cite all these documents, all these transactions. checks, deposits, wire transfers.
Of course, on extradition, really the issue is identity, whether that's the person.
No, Your Honor, not in this case. That was the issue in Kishamu. But in this case, the extradition question was, is there a prima facie case presented? And the foreign court said that there wasn't, again, because the government's evidence.
It's just so curious that a judge in Pakistan can address that question where there's no judge in the United States that could do that, because the indictment itself conclusively establishes that proposition. It's very strange.
Well, Your Honor, this is an international system.
The result you assert would make Pakistan a very popular a travel spot for potential indictees.
Well, I don't know about that, Your Honor. Again, Mr. Bukhari didn't flee. He's a Pakistani citizen.
He has dual citizenship.
He does have dual citizenship. That's correct. But it you know, it's not like he headed out to Hong Kong to avoid process. In fact, he went through the process. He went through the extradition process and he prevailed. And in fact, all he really did was put the government to its burden of proof. All he did was say, "Show me your prima facie case," and the government's evidence was found to be wanting. And
is this Pakistani law with regard to this accomplice testimony being insufficient in and of itself?
Yes, that was part of the inquiry magistrate's ruling. He applied Pakistani evidence law, and he said that under our law, a mere accusation from an accomplice is insufficient if it's not corroborated with a disinterested witness or with some documents. And he faulted the government for producing zero documents to prove these transactions that were said to have occurred. I think this is an important point in judging the speedy trial argument, is that the government has to pursue a defendant with due diligence. And the inquiry magistrate gave the government a roadmap. He said, come back to me with some documents, come back to me with the affidavit of a witness who's not an accomplice, and I'll take another look at this. And they weren't interested enough in the case to do that. They never came back. It's clear.
I have an impression that the United States authorities were told that the judge's decision in Pakistan would be appealed, and that they haven't gotten any more information about that.
The reason why you say
it's final, but
yes, Your Honor,
have the United States authorities been notified of the finality?
Well, the reason why there's some doubt about this, Your Honor, is that the government didn't put any evidence to this effect in the record in the district court. They had the opportunity, of course, to do so, and they didn't. Now, I can tell you that there was an attempted appeal, but because extradition rulings are not appealable, it was rejected the same month that it was filed. What you can do with an extradition ruling is renew your request with better evidence. And they had the chance to do that, but they just didn't care about this case enough. They could have come back with some documents. They could have come back with the affidavit of someone who is not an accomplice. And they just didn't care enough to do that. And that's part of the reason why, under the very important factor of who is more responsible for the delay, has the government exercised due diligence, that factor goes to Mr. Bukhari, because they had a roadmap and they didn't take it.
Refresh my recollection, counsel, please. Have other courts treated delays resulting from the defendant's chosen absence as the government's responsibility?
Well,
For Speedy Trial Act purposes?
Well, I think this is not a case where we're talking about just we choose to be absent. He's lawfully.
Of course, he chooses to be absent.
But there's more than that, Your Honor. With respect, the government failed to present a prima facie case under.
If he wants a speedy trial, he can have it next month, I'm sure.
Well, Your Honor, before you get on the plane from Lahore and fly to Wisconsin, there are certain duties that the government has to discharge, and one of those duties is making out a prima facie case.
They've done that to a grand jury in the Eastern District of Wisconsin.
They didn't do it to the extradition court.
And I understand that, and apparently the government is unable to secure his attendance here. But that doesn't mean that we're required to dance to his tune at this point.
Well, I think given that he prevailed in that process, it's a legally required process, one that they initiated, and they didn't follow up with the roadmap given to them by the inquiry magistrate, the diligence factor cuts against them. If I may, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Ms. Wallace?
May it please the Court. Shawna Wallace for the United States. I'd actually like to start by correcting some misunderstandings that opposing counsel seems to have about the extradition process. Part of the extradition request that the United States submitted to Pakistan was indeed an affidavit of a co-conspirator, which under U.S. law would be sufficient to establish probable cause. It also included three affidavits from investigators involved in the matter, which were two more than are normally required at an extradition request. Those affidavits detailed all the documents that those investigators looked at in arriving at this case, and that included all of the falsified...
But the Pakistani judge chose to ignore it?
Yes, Your Honor. The Pakistani barrister, I believe, who was representing the United States in the proceeding...
that was my other question. Who was representing the United States, your office?
Representing the United States was a Pakistani barrister named Mohammed Saif, and the Pakistani magistrate applying Pakistani evidentiary law, and I'm not going to venture to pronounce the legal code, said that it found it wanting in order to extradite extradition. That Pakistani barrister, to the next point, informed our Office of International Affairs and Department of Justice that the matter had been appealed, and he would be back in touch with us at the end of the summer recess and let us know what was happening. That was the last that we have heard about this case, despite repeated requests for further information. The defendant here, for the first time on appeal, raised the issue as to whether or not the matter was appealed, citing cases in the United States that United States defendants do not have a right to appeal their extradition rulings, which I believe to be correct for United States law. I do not believe that to be correct for Pakistani law, and that was not what was represented to us by Pakistani governmental representatives. So we have never
represented otherwise, has he?
No, and nor have we received formal notification that the process is terminated, which is typically what the government receives at the end of an extradition proceeding.
Is he the one that was going to file with Interpol, too?
So, Your Honor, if there are any further questions about the Pakistani proceeding...
Well, I'm somewhat serious about that question. Who was going to follow up with Interpol with regard to...
Yeah, so the initial request that we made with Interpol to issue a red notice was made when the first indictment was issued. There was a superseding indictment a number of months later, and we made an amended request to issue a red notice. Those requests get transmitted to the FBI office in Milwaukee, which then transmits it to a central office in FBI, which then transmits that request to Interpol. Our best guess is that somehow the two different notices caused some confusion. We were not notified of that, and in 2009, when we went to renew the extradition request, as it does need to be renewed every 5 years, that was actually the first time that the red notice was instituted. It is due to be renewed again this summer. We are on top of it. It was renewed. So there's now a red notice in place. And there's always been a border watch in place.
There is one.
Yes. Do you have a question, Mr. Hammer? No.
Sorry.
So the district court in this case did appropriately apply the fugitive disentitlement doctrine under the circumstances of this case. To allow immediate appellate review for this type of claim would be to privilege fugitive defendants over defendants who submit to the jurisdiction of this court.
Well, I'm curious about Judge Hamilton's question regarding appeal, the jurisdiction. Could it be split? Is it conceivable that we would have jurisdiction over the fugitivity question?
We're over comity, but not speedy trial.
Right.
So there's several points. I guess to start with Judge Hamilton's question about Kashamu. There, the finding of appellate jurisdiction was specifically premised on the defendant's allegation that there was a collateral estoppel claim. Thus, by analogy to a sovereign immunity claim or a double jeopardy claim, they made the leap into a 1291 jurisdiction.
Our colleagues made that leap. This court made that leap.
I apologize.
Whether we would do that in a first instance, I don't know, but that's the precedent in this circuit. And it's hard for me to distinguish between the comity argument and the collateral estoppel argument for those purposes.
Yes, this is a very vague comedy argument. As opposing counsel was very clear while he was up here, he is not asserting a collateral estoppel claim here, because all of the issues that would be required for that finality of decision, some assessment of the fullness of the proceedings.
If we take his point of view, there is a kind of finality to this. The Pakistan decision has been made, and that's sufficient to impose an obligation on the United States government to dismiss the indictment.
I do not know of any case where finality has been found due to the action of a defendant refusing to stand trial. First of all, I don't know that we credit his emphatic optimism that he will never stand trial. Second of all, that would seem to create quite a perverse incentive for other defendants in terms of wanting to gain immediate appellate review for rulings which will essentially be advisory at the district court level, since the defendant is very clear that it will have no effect on him. Under existing collateral order doctrine jurisprudence, there are a set of categories which are eligible for immediate appellate review. And
This is not something the Supreme Court has said, but Kashamu has said it. Why shouldn't we follow Kashamu here with respect to the comedy argument?
I believe from the factual distinctions of the case, in that there was an issue that one might have been able to claim could have precluded something in the litigation, such as the identity of the defendant. And Kashamu was also clear on this point. While defendant characterizes it as a decision that held that a foreign magistrate's ruling could be owed comedy, at the end of the day, it held that it was not owed comedy.
Exactly. But the merits were before the court. And it was rejected.
Yes. That is true. But it became before the court because of the specific factual representations of the case that are just not present here. Even under Abney for a double jeopardy claim, it has to be a colorable assertion of a claim in order to get immediate appellate review. This claim is, I don't even know what the vague assertion of comedy means in this context. And certainly, when you look at the merits of the comedy claim, it seems inconceivable that a court here would discharge a grand jury indictment based on a non-final proceeding of a Pakistani magistrate extradition process that still hasn't concluded. So if that's the premise of his immediate appellate review argument...
Yeah, but it still hasn't concluded. You haven't tried to reopen it, have you?
No, while we've inquired as to where the status is...
You lost your lawyer or something.
Radio silence, is that the term? So?
Yes, it's been a number of years.
If we agree with you and either dismiss the appeal or affirm the denial of relief, could we be seeing the same issues 10 years from now, 20 years from now, in this case?
Your Honor, I imagine that's possible. The limiting principle, I think, here is that the United States ultimately does bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that a defendant is guilty. And the United States, checks its cases periodically to ensure that. It has to do that in order to renew the red notice. And at the point at which we don't believe that we have a case, we would dismiss the indictment. But that's certainly not for Mr. Bokhari to say.
Is the barrister that you hired there a contract to the Justice Department?
No, Your Honor.
You don't know or no?
No, there it's not. He's not. So defendants...
So why not just try again in Pakistan? Follow this roadmap.
Yes. Well, so part of this is the misunderstanding here of what was included in the extradition request. All of the affidavits detailed in great length what mm-hmm. the documents were, including all of the financial documents that were evidence of the money laundering claims, all of the falsified applications under the E-rate program that were evidence of the fraud. For the magistrate judge in Pakistan to then demand all of those documents be produced in Pakistan, as well as affidavits of other individuals that were involved in the conspiracy, as well as statements by the prosecution as to what in our view, the role of another co-conspirator was, as well as prosecutorial statements of their intention as to another accomplice, all the business documents relating to the defendant's multiple companies that were involved in the E-rate scheme. It was a trial's worth of evidence, and it is fairly unprecedented.
Is it unprecedented in Pakistan?
Our Office of International Affairs, when I've asked them, had not seen a ruling exactly like this. But there have not been any rulings since 2008. So defendant's main argument is premised upon muddling the law of who is a fugitive, which under any number of contexts in which that term is used, Mr. Bukhari meets that definition. While the government believes that it is not relevant to this inquiry as to whether or not Mr. Bukhari fled the jurisdiction, and while the district court did make a factual finding as to that point, that it was reasonable to believe that that's exactly what happened.
I suppose you can flee the jurisdiction even though you happen to be a citizen of the country to which you go to.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court in Sapanji have summed up the concept of fugitive as follows. If you're told to surrender and you don't, you're a fugitive. The real question here is not whether or not he's a fugitive. It's whether or not the extradition process has some sort of magical quality to it that turns him from a fugitive to a non-fugitive by prevailing in the extradition process. And while the extradition process does result in him not being extradited, it should not result in him having his indictment dismissed in the United States. I believe the defendant's case also rests upon an unjustifiably expansive view of this court's opinion in Hijazi. This case is simply not like Hijazi. In Hijazi, there was an individual who was not a U.S. citizen who committed his crimes abroad and whose contacts with the United States were so attenuated that this court found them fairly non-existent. Here you have a U.S. citizen who committed his crimes on U.S. soil and defrauded U.S. taxpayers and disadvantaged schools in Wisconsin and Illinois. There's no question that there's jurisdiction over this matter, nor has this case raised any delicate foreign relations issues. One of the insights of the Hijazi opinion was that in that case, the stalemate in part stemmed from a face-off over two sovereign nations' interpretations of the extraterritorial application of the statute at issue. While Kuwait had registered its objection to the extension of this statute's application to conduct in Kuwait by a foreign national, it also asked that in the alternative that at least a U.S. court rule on this issue so that it could understand that a U.S. court believed this statute did in fact have that type of extraterritorial application. This court, noting that factor, commented that it would be thus helpful to have a district court rule on that issue because it might move the ball forward. It might make Kuwait more likely to extradite Hijazi to the United States, or if he were to leave and be picked up on the red notice, another country to extradite him to the United States. There's no such dynamic here. In fact, if anything, the opposite is true. While this defendant may have an incentive, as he has many contacts in the United States, including children who are U.S. citizens, to come to this jurisdiction if he believes his motion to dismiss the indictment has merit and receive a ruling while here. To the extent the court is directed to rule on those motions now, that motion now, and it rules against him, that would remove even that incentive for him to come and submit to this court's jurisdiction.
Just more fundamentally, I guess, if you went to trial on the fraud case, you'll have to prove, I mean, we're at that stage where you have to prove that he fraudulently, or he and somebody else fraudulently induced these school corporations on it.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And this is actually a very document heavy case, and those documents have all been preserved. And so, as Your Honor pointed out, we do stand ready and willing to provide him the trial that he says that he seeks. In addition, to go back to the appellate jurisdiction question, while we do not believe that a new category of claim should be committed, should be created for fugitive defendants to remotely litigate their motions and then gain special access to the appellate review process, we also do not believe the doctrine of practical finality applies here either. In this circuit, the two contexts in which that doctrine has been employed are either in cases where an agency has, where a district court remands a decision back to an agency, which is normally not immediately appealable, and the agency has no choice but to either comply with that ruling and then not appeal later or be held in contempt. Alternatively, it's been used in the context, this is Penfold v. Jackson, where some sort of asset has been transferred before the end of the litigation, and there is a danger that it won't be recovered at the end of the litigation. Sometimes in this circuit, that is also referred to as the Conrad Forgay rule, and in other circuits, the doctrine of practical finality is typically equated to the Conrad Forgay rule.
Would there, to get back to your barrister in Pakistan,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, we're not in a position to order you to pursue that. You're already pursuing it voluntarily.
Yes, Your Honor.
But nothing's happened.
No, nothing has happened at this point.
Why don't we wait till see what happens?
That has been the United States government's plan, and we continue to continue to plan on inquiring every chance that we have. To the extent this court views this case as under a petition for a writ of mandamus, I think it is telling that the defendant does not even lay out the standard for the issuance of such a writ because it is clear he cannot meet it. There are no jurisdictional questions here that are at issue. There are no special considerations, and he has not demonstrated that he has an indisputable right to the writ. Not only is the district court's decision colorable, but his substantive claims are meritless. If the court has any further questions, Thank you very much, Your Honor.
How much time? You have 1 minute, counsel.
Three quick points, Your Honors. You have jurisdiction over the speedy trial claim as well as the comedy claim. The district court denied the motion to dismiss. The speedy trial claim was raised in that motion. The order is appealable. Therefore, you have jurisdiction over the whole motion to dismiss, both the comedy argument and the speedy trial argument. Second, with respect to the alleged lack of notification from
Back up. Why is that? I'm thinking, for example, a couple of years ago, Judge Caney and I were involved in some cases involving claims out of the Hungarian Holocaust that presented a number of appellate jurisdiction problems, and we wound up concluding that we had jurisdiction over some issues and not others. Were we wrong about that? Are we able to? We were rejecting the idea of supplemental appellate jurisdiction with respect to those issues.
Well, I'm not saying you're wrong about that. I'm not familiar with that case. But there was a motion that was made, and the order denies that motion. I would say that if the order is appealable, that brings up all the bases for the motion. So I think the
if the district judge wrote two separate orders, one dealing with one issue, the other with the other, would that make a difference?
I think it might. I think if they're separate orders, then if one order is appealable and one isn't, then that is, it is
so
what
that,
it is.
So that's how Speedy Trial Act denials wind up, just by writing it in the same piece.
But look, we think the speedy trial argument is just as appealable because it's all final as a practical matter, and that's just as true for the speedy trial argument as it is for the comedy argument. If I could just make one quick point about the alleged lack of notification from the Pakistani barrister, they didn't put any evidence of that in the record. There's nothing before the district court. There are no emails between the DOJ and the barrister. They didn't put that evidence in the record. They created an affidavit that they filed that was dated 2 days before their appellate brief. That affidavit can't be considered. The fact of the matter is this appeal was rejected within the same month that it was filed. It's 7 years later. You think it's the appeal is really ongoing. It's not. So the last thought I would leave with the court is the fact that Mr. Bukhari put the government to its burden of proof and the government failed to provide a prima facie case doesn't make him a fugitive and doesn't make him responsible for the 10 years of delay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks to both counsel.